breastfeeding zombies, and coconut elves. Your space is now my space. And how to cure smartphone addiction. All that, and Georgia Dow is here with so much more coming up on Tech News Today.
This is Twit.
Bandwidth for Tech News Today is provided by CashFly at CacheFly.com.
This is Tech News Today, episode 1811, recorded Monday, July 17th, 2017. This episode of Tech News Today is brought to you by the Ring Video Doorbell. With Ring, you can see and talk to anyone at your door from anywhere in the world using your smartphone. It's like caller ID for your home. Go to ring.com/TNT and get up to $150 off a Ring of Security kit. Welcome to Tech News Today. This is the show where we talk about some of the biggest tech news stories. I am Megan Maroney. Jason Howell is on a much-deserved vacation. But joining me today is the fabulous Georgia Dow. Welcome to the show, Georgia, psychotherapist and senior editor at iMore.
Hey, Megan.
You were on Twit yesterday. You're on TNT today. We can't get enough of you.
I thought you were going to say we can't get rid of you.
We can't get enough of
both.
You. Well, thank you so much. Of course, if you haven't seen Georgia, she is amazing. Like I said, a psychotherapist. I'm going to ask her a lot about feelings. Plus, she is an iPhone expert, a gamer, an all-around tech aficionado. So let's get to the news. The biggest story of the day, of course, is that it's World Emoji Day. And Apple has released some new emoji. They showed us what they will release in iOS 11. Plus, Google is getting rid of the blob emoji, which is very sad. Let's start with the Apple news. There's breastfeeding zombies, coconut elves, T-Rex sandwiches. That's just some of the emoji coming. Of course, that's the breastfeeding emoji, the zombie emoji, the coconut and the elf. Not all together. Don't expect everything. There's T-Rex and the sandwich. Although I definitely want to see breastfeeding zombies in the future, and I have made my request known to Jeremy Burge, who is the originator of World Emoji Day. Among the other many ways the world is celebrating, London's Royal Opera House will present 20 well-known operas and ballets in emoji form online, and those are ballets and operas that I would like to sit through. How are you feeling on World Emoji Day, Georgia?
Hearts. Happy face, sad blob. I love emojis. I think that they're fun. I think that they serve a purpose. Like there's 60 million emojis are used every day on Facebook and 5 billion on Messenger every single day. So this is something that's here to stay for all emoji haters. I'm sorry, but I think that you're on the wrong side of history for this one. Emojis serve a great purpose. They're just a nice way to show emotion through your text messages. So I'm happy to have World Emoji Day. I will try to text only and tweet only in emojis that day, unless it's something professional, and see how it goes.
Yeah, you should do. I mean, you're a therapist, so you should see. You just hold up pictures of emoji during one of your appointments. I think that would...
Write a Rorschach test. Yeah.
Yeah, yeah.
How does this make you feel? Do you have emoji rage?
Exactly. Burke thinks it's now time for all of us to request our emojis that we want. And he wants a chainsaw arm emoji, which would serve all kinds of purposes, I think. Yes. Thank you.
I like that one. I like that one. Renee wants a Putin emoji.
Yeah. You know what? I saw someone tweet, why isn't there an emoji for emoji?
Oh. That's very inception.
Makes you stop and think, doesn't it? I don't even know what it would be. Okay, so I feel, as I think you do as well, that emoji are often good for explaining. They're more specific in how you're feeling than just words can be. But today, iTunes had, they changed the iTunes movie section to all, instead of all the movie titles, they're all emoji. And I tried to figure out what the movies were, and I couldn't figure out any of them. So now I have to rethink this whole thing, that emoji. I think I have that link in there, Brian, under, oh, maybe I don't have it. Maybe it's under Apple, but it's, if you go to iTunes and search for movies, I don't know if you can get to iTunes there. It was very confusing. So, I don't know. Did you check that out, Georgia?
No, I didn't see it, but emoji definitely are not great for actually speaking, like for a language. They're not great. Words are definitely better for language. Emoji are better for intonation and feeling. And so a lot of the emojis that are there are not as helpful because they're saying a word that many people may interpret depending on where they live, depending on their use of language, depending on their you know, ethnic background. It's going to mean completely different things. So I think that emojis, really where they shine is intonation, inflection, and emotion. And that's where language, actually written language, has a weakness, because 80% of language is done through body language, the way that we speak, the loudness to way we speak, how we deal with it. And that's why if you're ever going to have an argument, you really don't want to do that through text message or an email. Mm-hmm. But emoji can help out in that. But no, I'm not great when people send me a list of emoji. One is it stresses me because I'm having to do a lot of thinking, where words would do a better job to that. And I think that they're funny in some ways, but I think that it wouldn't be something that could actually replace language.
Mm-hmm. BKK Canuck in the chat room wanted to be clear that he believes Renee wants a poutine, not a Putin emoji, right?
Poutine, yes.
Poutine. Okay. Because everyone knows that they don't make emoji out of real people. So as much as we all want the Putin emoji, it will never be, because the Unicode says no emoji of people. So I think the first emoji I would want was Putin, and then the second one would be an emoji of you.
Right. Thank you for letting us know that, because that could have ended very poorly for me. So thank you.
Okay. Security researcher Leanne Galloway says that anyone can gain access to your old MySpace account as long as you know someone's birthday. Galloway notified MySpace of the flaw back in April, but they sent her an automated response and then did not fix it. Only when this huge security hole became public today in a more public fashion than this researcher's blog did MySpace plug the hole. I'm not sure what people could do once they took control of your account. I mean, I guess they could post embarrassing things up there, but let's just admit all of our MySpaces would be embarrassing if someone came upon them today. And it is still very bad security. Even though people aren't really spending that much time on MySpace, I am still shocked that they would not verify emails.
No, it's a really scary thing. I think that, like, especially when you're talking about social media that you've used a really long time ago, we you know, that right to be able to be forgotten is really important, and to make sure that all of our accounts are secure. I'm just sad that they only used an automatic response, and so they didn't even read it.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
That's really scary.
It is. I mean, I guess they've just basically closed up shop over there, but I mean, a lot of people's stuff there, and it really is a good lesson that to not let these accounts just lie dormant. And I was listening to Reply All. I don't know if you ever listened to that podcast, but they did this whole story on LiveJournal, and LiveJournal is now owned by a Russian company, or like it's owned by the Russian government, essentially, LiveJournal is. So if you still have your LiveJournal out there, not only is it probably super embarrassing depending on how old you were when you were LiveJournaling, but it's now the Russian government can use it any way they would like.
And that's the problem with social media, is that anyone can take over, and our the ULIP can change, and so that it can be changing hands with that. I guess that the sad part is I don't think that there's an easy way to delete everything off of your MySpace either. Did you have MySpace?
I don't think that I did. Like, I remember it, but it was certainly it wasn't a place that I hung out. I think it was like right after my first child was born. So I think I was a breastfeeding zombie at that point. So I don't think I did, but I honestly can't even remember. Did you?
No, I didn't. I'm feeling really good about that now. Yeah. I'm happy actually there wasn't much internet when I was a child either, just because of the stuff that would be on there would be always embarrassing and or humiliating to the stuff that I do. Though I wore a Magikarp hat yesterday, so I guess I shouldn't be complaining. So you'd have to go through and selectively delete, I believe, everything, but that seems like a pain. And, you know, for people, how do they still get onto their MySpace account? I guess all they need is their birth date, so.
Yeah, I mean, yeah, if you didn't know. They've closed it now, so they've closed the hole. So now you need your birthday. You need to know someone's birthday and their email address, and it'll confirm and all that stuff. So now they've been publicly shamed into being more secure. But, yeah, I definitely had a live journal, and it's definitely still out there. It's not really that embarrassing. It was just the stuff when I was on Tech TV. But, yeah, now not only can anybody online look at it, but it's now owned by the Russian government. So if they wanted to use those reviews that I did of monitors in 2002, they can.
Blackmail stuff there.
Exactly. Facebook CEO Mark Zuckerberg's net worth has reached a record high of $66.7 billion as shares of his own company has continued to rise. Meanwhile, he is not running for president, despite his carefully controlled appearances all over the United States. Now, Georgie, you found an interesting piece in the Wall Street Journal about how people are upset that Zuckerberg is demanding all this privacy about his travels when he's played so fast and loose with all of our privacy for the past decade. Tell us a little bit about your thoughts about this piece.
Yeah, well, it's interesting because, you know, what he's learned from having everyone's personal information over the last 13 years is that he really doesn't want other people to have his personal information itself. So he set out a whole bunch of rules when he went on this American tour. So one of them was that you won't know when he's coming. If you do know that he's coming, please keep it to yourself. So don't post it on Facebook. And then be careful what you reveal yourself about the meeting. And that has caused a lot of people to be really upset. And when I first heard that, I was upset as well. We care a lot about, we actually have an internal part of our brain that deals with the feeling of injustice. And that's kind of interesting that, you know, we've done, there's all kinds of experiments that we've done with things that are not just. And it is linked to our own set of social status, belonging, and respect. And so I thought that it was really cool that our brains automatically evaluate if something is fair and how financial rewards are distributed. And if they're not distributed in a way that we feel is socially equitable, then we get really angry. And it's the same area of our brain that deals with anger and rage and disgust.
And in our important discussions of this today, you also brought up a video, which I think, Brian, we have the Franz de Waal TED Talk Equity Experiment, which involves monkeys. So I don't know if we should. She'll describe it.
Yeah, here the monkeys are getting fed just for a cucumber. They will happily give a little rock to get this cucumber, and they're happy to do that. But then one of the capuchin monkeys sees the other one getting a grape for returning the rock, and look at his reaction when he only gets a cucumber. He not only is he angry, but he's really angry, and he's smashing the ground, and he threw the cucumber away. So really, if you thought about it, it's not just about financial reward, because if it was so, he'd be at least getting a cucumber is better than nothing. But because of this huge inequity, injustice, he's like, you know what? Forget this. Not only is he's trying to hit the person with it. So he wants revenge, and he's not even going to eat the cucumber as he watches. So I just think that that's amazing that it has nothing to do with, you know, just greed. Because if he said, yeah, well, cucumber is better than nothing. But no, he's like, you know what? This isn't fair. I would rather have nothing.
So in this scenario.
And that's what happened. Yeah.
In this scenario, which is us, and we're the monkey throwing things, right?
We're the monkey that's getting the cucumber, in that he is expecting, why people are upset is because he's expecting all of this privacy to himself, whereas he's fine with, you know, taking everyone else's privacy and getting to do whatever he wants with it. Now, of course, the main argument to that would be the reason for that is that you choose to go on Facebook. No one is being forced to be placed on Facebook. But the reason that people are upset when he came out with all of these rules of like extreme privacy were that people are like, well, this does not seem fair that this is the way that you would feel about it. But that's what happens when you've been doing this for a living. You're like, you know what? Controlling media and what media says about you is really important.
And I mean, and Zuckerberg has had like a really interesting growth period. We basically watched him, you know, grow up from when he was in college and just, you know, had a different idea of what privacy was. Like, it just his idea, his guiding principle was, you know, everyone should be open. Everyone should be who they are. And, you know, no one should need a fake name. No one should need anonymity. And of course, you know, he's learned along with, you know, he's learned that some people do need anonymity. And, you know, he has learned that about himself, but he is not giving that necessarily to people. I mean, the system works now where everyone has to use their real name. It works for some things, but not for other things.
No. And again, he's gathering like 600 trillion bytes of information every day on people. And I think that it's one of those things that once you put it out there, it's there forever. And I think that with the MySpace and, you know, we can look at, you know what, once you've put it out there, yeah, it's there forever. And so it's something that we should take a little bit more seriously. So I completely understand that capuchin monkey throwing back the cucumber.
And the other thing about the Wall Street Journal article that I thought was really fascinating was he has a dozen or so people deleting harassing comments about him. You know, that's their job. That's their only job. And so when you think about, you know, just, I hadn't thought about that. I mean, I think there's just so much privilege that we don't really think about. I was thinking about the pictures that have come out of Beyonce and her beautiful twins, and just like how I felt after I had twins, and everyone, you know, I tweeted that and everyone said, you know, you don't have all this help. Like, she has all this help. You know, I had a lot more help than many people, but not as much as Beyonce. But it's true. It's like when you think of when Zuckerberg says, like, Facebook is a wonderful place where everyone's open. Meanwhile, he has 12 people who their primary job is to delete harassing comments about him. You know, that is a kind of privilege that I think, you know, even a lot of, I mean, I guess, you know, more famous people could pay people to delete harassing comments about them, or they could get off the social network, which some do.
It could, but I think that it's one of those things that's also really hard to get off of once you're on and you're kind of connected to all different people. It would be nice if everyone's privacy was also protected at the same time. And you're right, there's definitely a huge amount of social inequity and financial inequity that's becoming a greater span between the haves and the have-nots.
So, you know, this is another thing, as long as I have you here so you can look into someone's brain, I think a lot about Mark Zuckerberg, and from what I've read, that, you know, he has enough money, obviously, to last him and his family the rest of his life. And he, you know, he said he's going to give away most of it. And he does a lot of good deeds. And, you know, from people that I've heard speak who do know him, he really believes in all this stuff. Like, he believes in his, he believes that he wants to get out there and meet people. And, you know, he believes in all of the causes that he's giving to. He's not just trying to look at the bottom line. So what do you think about that? I mean, what do you think about these people that are at the top of these companies that really could at this point do whatever they want and they would be fine? They're not really trying to, you know, steal all our personal information, or they're not trying, you know, all the things that Facebook gets accused of doing, you know, trying to find kids, for example, that might be anxious in order to target them with certain ads, that kind of thing. I mean, what do you think about that? Yeah, what do you think?
I think that he does, like, really do a lot of good, and I think that he has a lot of causes that he truly believes in. I think that that has been on the backs of other people's privacy, and so I think that that is a valid comment. I think that a lot of people like Warren Buffett and Bill Gates have done a lot of good, and the world is a better place because of them, and so I hope that he can do the same thing, but it is still at the loss of other people, and maybe it's just a minor loss for most people. They wouldn't care if everything that they ever posted on Facebook was you know, for the public to be able to see. I think that in some cases, though, it can be used to harm. And so that we need to be careful too. But I agree with you. I think that he does really care and he does a lot of good. And I think that he does, in a very controlled way, want to go out there and learn about more about, you know, America. And that may be because he may want to get into politics, or maybe he wants to, you know, start to give money away into certain causes that he feels very strongly about and make the world a better place, which is lovely.
Well, back in March, one fan of the game Overwatch had his assumptions about one of the game's playable characters confirmed. Part of the backstory of intriguing and intelligent Symmetra is that she is on the autism spectrum. According to gameplay and a comic that came out before the release, Symmetra is uncomfortable in crowds, goes out of her way to adjust crooked picture frames during important business meetings, and sometimes walks away from conversations while people are speaking to her. This week, Wired has a long piece on neurodiversity in video games and how only 9 other characters in all of video game history have been identified as autistic. What do you think about this story?
I love this. I think that there's definitely some people that are a little bit upset about the way that she is portrayed. I think that whenever you are portraying a specific group of people and there's not many other people that are being portrayed in a certain way, some people could say, well, that's not the way that autism is a very wide spectrum. And so everyone would experience that differently. And so in that way, sometimes we can end up with a character that becomes very popular. And so because of that, it becomes typecast. And we think that because we know this character, people would think that, you know, everyone that is on the spectrum would be similar to that. And that is not the case. But that's because there's not enough characters with diversity. It's lovely to see yourself being portrayed in a positive way. And that really changes things. To be able to play a video game where you can feel yourself represented in a way, and autism especially has been portrayed in media and film, usually in a negative way, or in a way that is awkward or strange and not positively. And so I'm really happy that this is a character that people enjoy playing. I enjoy that she's a character of color. I enjoy that it's different. And a lot of my clients that are on the spectrum are really happy about that. This meant a lot to them.
Yeah, I mean, I don't play Overwatch, but I know people who do. And I think, you know, there's all these different characters that you can choose to play, and you know, the idea is that there could be, we need more heroes, right? Like, that's the idea of the game. Mm-hmm. Like, we can always, you know, use more heroes. Like, I was reading through the comments of this, and some people are saying, well, they said she was on the spectrum at first because she's a light bender, or, you know, that she's not actually a good character, so why does suddenly everyone love her just because she's on the spectrum? But I think, I agree that I think that there's a reason that this game is so popular, and there really are people that just love this game, will play it forever. And I think it's great. The reason they confirmed this was that there was a boy who was on the spectrum, and he played and he chose to play this character and just assumed, and then wrote a letter to Blizzard and then got a letter back saying, you're right, which is great.
And they've done a lot of good with diversity. I think that that's like wonderful. I would love to see more of that. I would love to see more diversity also in body type. I think that that's something that in video games, we still end up with this very lean or strong male characters with lots of muscles and eight packs, and women that would be of different body shapes as well as men in different heights. I think that that's still an issue for video games. And I have a lot of people that are always trying to be thinner and stronger and dealing with that to fit into the kind of media typecast of what is a beautiful person. So I would love for the idea of beauty to be a huge wide range as well.
Mm-hmm. So the last video game that I actually played was on my, for real, like, you know, hours at a time, was on my Atari 2600, which might be coming back in some shape or form. We first heard of the brand new Atari product at E3, and now photos of this mystery box are beginning to appear online. It's called the Atari Box. And in a newsletter to fans, Atari says the product is meant to appeal to both old, that's me, and new fans of Atari. So you'll see those ribbed lines, a raised back, and part of it will be made of wood. Plus, it will have an HDMI port, 4 USB ports, and an SD slot. Do you have any guesses as to what this will do, what kind of games it will play?
Well, I'm really excited. I also play the Atari. My brother had one, and I loved it. I loved playing it. It was the first system that I got to play. So I'm really excited because they say that we're going to be having, you know, all the old games along with the new games that are there. So if you played like Adventure or Defender and other things, we're also going to get to play there. The cool part is that the mock-up shows an Ethernet port. So we might also get online play. So that might mean that we could play games together with your friends or online games that they're going to have as well to that, which is kind of cool. But we have to remember, this is like a CG mockup. There is not yet a build console that we're dealing with. And that's always a little bit of a worry, because they, like, the last thing that we've heard about this is that it's probably going to be crowdfunded. So that gives me a little bit of a pause. And they, what they, Atari said to their French investors was, to limit risk taking, this product will be initially launched within the framework of a crowdfunding campaign. So my hope is that it's not going to end up as vaporware with a lot of angry people because they don't have enough to design it and come out with a working product.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, because Atari, of course, has changed hands. The company has changed hands so many times. And they've come out with, you know, they've used the Atari name for all kinds of things in the last, you know, 5 or 6 years. And nothing has really caught on. And I think part of the mini NES, that popularity was just that it was so cheap. I mean, it was just like, oh, okay, yeah, I'll spend $150 on a device. And then it was scarce, too. That's also something that appeals to people, I think.
Yeah, false scarcity really does work. So I'm also, my only other worry would be, are they licensing this to a third party to actually manage the hardware? And so we don't know who's going to be the people that are going to be making it, which we don't yet know. So there's a few little, you know, red flags that might be up there, but I'm hoping that it'll come out and that it will play all the old games. That would be really interesting to me because it just brings back all of my childhood memories.
Mm-hmm. Burke thinks it's just publicity for Atari, and Patrick says they already made the Atari flashback, which he's talked about before, and he owned. And so... But we will see. Girls can hope, right?
Yeah.
Well, after the break, is smartphone addiction a real thing? Dr. Georgia explains. But first, let's take a minute to thank the Ring Video Doorbell, the sponsor of this episode. Ring's mission is to make neighborhoods safer. Today, over 1 million people use the amazing Ring Video Doorbell to help protect their homes. Before the show, I was telling you about how my parents have it, and I was staying at their home while they were across the world. And I had Georgia and her husband over for dinner, and my parents knew. So Ring kept their house safe from scary Georgia Dow. Ring knows home security begins at the front door, but it does not end there. That's why they're extending the same level of security to the rest of your home with the Ring Floodlight Cam. Just like a Ring video doorbell, Floodlight Cam is a motion-activated camera and a floodlight that connects to your phone. It has HD video and two-way audio. It lets you know the moment anyone steps on your property. You can see and speak to visitors, even set off an alarm right from your phone. With Ring's Floodlight Cam, when things go bump in the night, you will immediately know what is doing that bumping. So whether you're home or away, the Ring Floodlight Cam lets you keep an eye on your home. Ring Floodlight Cam offers the ultimate in home security with high visibility floodlights and a powerful HD camera that puts security in your hands. It was named the Wall Street Journal's Best of CES 2017. Monitor every corner of your property with a Ring of Security kit. All kits include a Ring video doorbell and your choice of either 1, 2, or 3 floodlight cams. Connect your Ring video doorbell with your favorite smart locks and hubs for added convenience, monitoring, and security. With Ring, you are always home. Save up to $150 off a Ring of Security kit when you go to ring.com/TNT. That's ring.com/TNT. And we thank Ring for their support.
I will be getting that.
You will. 1, 2, or 3, yes, depending on the house size.
I will do minimum two, possibly 3. It's just nice to have.
It is. I know. It really is. I never thought I would be like a camera person on my house, but it's just like once you get that security, once you've felt that security, I think it's hard to go back from that.
Yeah.
So among my internet wanderings today, I came upon a piece on Medium about smartphone addiction. It was written by a woman named Lisa Beyer. And unlike so many, many articles online that try to scare parents into curling up in a little ball and then hiding in their closet until their kids turn 25, this one had some real anecdotes and real suggestions. And Lisa Beyer, she's a marketing expert. She wrote a book called Social PR Secrets, and she's a professor also, and she's a mom of a 15-year-old. So it really just goes through where she got to the point where she had to just take her daughter's phone away from her and just the phases that her daughter went through after getting it taken away and kind of what parents could do. What did you think of the piece, Georgia?
Oh, I think it's a great piece. It's absolutely accurate. We do go through, like, even for us. So you can think with us with developed brains, which have like prefrontal lobes that are fully, you know, past the age of 24. So they're fully thought of what are the consequences to our actions. Phones were put into the hands with all kinds of very addicting apps that are made to become more addicting, to create more dopamine in our system. So if I often, like, how far away is your phone from you right now, Megan? Like, if we're doing the show, but usually how far would your phone be from you?
Even during the show, I think about that too. I'm like, why do I even have it here?
It's like right here, right? Yep. My phone right here. It's like always there. It's never far away from me. The same thing for even when I go to sleep. And if I leave to go to work and my phone is not with me, and I have a telephone in my office, I will often go back to get my phone.
Yeah.
This is our feeling of security, our connection to the world. But for teens, for kids as they develop, we are changing the patterns of their brain. And that's accurate. We are increasing that feeling of need. It's the same thing as being addicted to drugs. And so when Lisa was talking about that feeling of withdrawal that her kids went through, her daughter went through when she took away for her phone for a week, it is absolutely accurate. It is one of the most difficult addictions that I deal with in my practice. And I deal with like cocaine, smoking, drinking, but teen use of social media and their smartphones is the one that I have the least amount of success with. And I'm working with the parents and the teen themselves. And that becomes really difficult. Someone did give it up for a puppy. You know, so we'll see how long that lasts. That's not usually the most accurate way, but we'll see what happens to it. But this is not like they're not learning anything that's really useful most of the time when they're on their smartphone.
So, I mean, I have a friend who gave her daughter a puppy. It lasted about a year. And then, I mean, the puppy's still there.
But it
put off the phone for another year. And that's another thing. You can just put it off for as long as possible.
Yes. And maybe also just not, like, they could have the phone, but not be on social media and be, you know, with all of these addicting applications. You want to wait the longest amount possible for that. Mm-hmm. Because that's where we end up with addiction. And cell phones and technology in general, and I love technology. Like if you look like around, I have like everything, as you know, around me. But, you know, that takes up our space of like free time when we are usually the most productive and the most happy moments happen to us are during those idle times. And so like me playing Plants vs. Zombies or going on social media, it takes up the time when I would be doing most of my developmental time. And that's what teens are missing as they try to learn social skills, problem solving, dealing with other people, dealing with anger and anxiety. They're not going to be doing it. They're going to be getting practice that instead they avoid. And you don't want to have that because that's how you end up with an anxiety disorder.
So I have heard many people say, you know, we're going to look back in 20 years and say, why did we give our kids these cell phones when they were 9, 10, 11? It's going to be just like cigarettes. We're going to say, like, why did we do that? But is there really any data to back that up, that it is as bad as cocaine addiction, like you said? Or, you know, have there been studies? Is there any data? Or is it just like what you're seeing in your practice?
It's absolutely not conjecture. It's not conjecture. If you look at a brain scan of someone with going through an addiction to social media versus an addiction to cocaine, you will see the exact same dopamine reaction to when they get their hit and they get their phone back and they can go on to, you know, Instagram or whatever else it is that they're addicted to. You'll see exactly the same brainwave pattern. And when you deal with someone that's going through withdrawal, how do you know that something, which is a good question, really, how do you know that something is an addiction versus something that is just I enjoy and I get to use it? So the one thing is that does it affect my day-to-day life? So am I choosing to go on to Snapchat instead of going out with my friends? Or am I not doing my homework because I'm going to be using my phone to do something? Does it actually affect us? And then the second question that I always ask is, do you have to have it or do you want to have it? Like, can you actually stop? if you took away your phone for a day, how much withdrawal would you go through? And that's a really active measure to that. And so I will often ask teens and also adults, I say, well, like, let's try it. Let's try it out for a day. See if you can do that. And what happens to you when you go through that? And then we can tell, is this really an addiction to that? But if you want to know for the data, yes, there's actual data that this does, one, change the patterning of our brains. So we end up becoming, video games actually in general, one of the, they're not bad, and I love video games, and I do a podcast on video games, but they do change that need for delay and gratification. And there's lots of studies on that. They decrease our ability to delay gratification because things happen immediately. And so that, our entire culture is getting worse at. And it's interesting because I was just thinking about it the other day. I was watching a show that had a commercial, and during the commercial, I went onto my phone and played Plants vs. Zombies. I'm not proud of this, but I did. I could not even handle, like, and it wasn't even seconds. It was like seconds into the commercial, and I already took my phone out and I went, wow. And sometimes I'm actually watching a TV show and I'm on my phone, and I went, that has to end. So, you know, as an adult and knowing how addictive it can be, think about someone that their brain is actually developing into who they're going to be as a person. And so kids that may lean towards having ADHD, anxiety problems, anger problems, these would be our most at-risk youth, and this would cause the most damage to their own development.
So you said, you know, what if a child chooses to be on their phone instead of being with their friends? What, I'm sure you've heard this argument from patients. What if they say, well, that's where my friends are? Like, that is how I communicate with my friends. If you cut off my, if you give away my phone, if you make me delete Snapchat, I'm going to have no way to communicate with my friends. I'm going to feel isolated.
And they will. At first they will. And there are a lot of people, like there's less kids outside, right? Like there just are. Right? There's not kids running around playing. They're inside usually playing video games or talking to their friends on social media. The thing is that if you don't, you could go to your friend's house and actually see them in person. The problem is that you're missing. We are not learning and teaching our youth how to read facial movements, intonation, body language. So they're getting worse at that, which is a huge skill that you need to work today, to be able to see people. And that's going to be one of the skills that are going to be most looked at. And so, yes, at first you will go through a feeling of withdrawal. It will look similar to a feeling of depression. Probably you'll be really angry and you will feel cut off. Your levels of FOMO will go really high. But then you will end up, you know, deciding to ask your friends to go out and do something and make better friends. And we do also know that the more that you use social media, so especially Instagram, Facebook, is that your levels of sadness and lack of feeling that your life is meaningful also goes down. So it does increase anxiety and depression as well. And again, I use these things and I like them. I don't use Facebook, but I use a lot of social media and I enjoy them, but they have their place to that. And it can become where you're looking at everyone else having this wonderful life and you're saying to yourself, but my life does not, isn't as good, isn't as fun, because it's this fake life that we're looking from everyone else. Rarely do people put on, I'm eating bonbons and watching, you know, a TV show and staying home on a Saturday night on their Facebook feed.
Rarely do people say, I just had to play Plants vs. Zombies during the commercial. Because
right.
So what about some tips about just scaling back? Like, what, you know, could you say to a kid, you know, cut down the amount of friends that you have? Like, don't be following a lot of people that you don't know, because, you know, what's the point of that? Just maybe keep it to your friends that you're really interested in what they're doing. Or, you know, is there, you know, not reading the comments, I guess, like, you know, I've definitely heard that, like, if, you know, a child is being cyberbullied or even an adult, like, just don't read the comments, that kind of thing. Is there any like tips instead of just like cold turkey?
Yeah, you can try to scale back. It's really hard to. So you could get rid of one. Like, you'd say, I'm going to cut back on the level of social media of which I use and just keep Facebook or just keep Twitter or Instagram and see about that. And also try to watch out on all of their lures that they try to pull you in. So Snapchat streaks is a great way that they've figured out through, you know, the psychology of how the brain works, of people, once they have gathered a certain amount of internet creds, they don't want to give them up. And so they could, you know, you could say, like, you know, you have to break you know, this many streaks and try to see if you can do it, it becomes very difficult. It's easier to cut out a full set of social media then, because like once you're on, you know, Facebook or Twitter, you're like, I'll just be on for 5 minutes. Rarely, it's like eating a potato chip. It's rarely just 5 minutes. You think that it's 5 minutes and then an hour's gone by of your time. And you will never look back on your life when you're 90 and say, you know what, I wish I spent more time on Facebook. No one has ever said that to me, and that will never be said in time. But you may say, I wish that I had learned a language, or I wish that I traveled more, or I wish that I'd spent more time with friends, had more laughter, been more silly, experienced more of life. And so that's the greatest sadness with social media, is it's taking away the most precious moments of our time. And it makes time seem like if I've spent a lot of time on technology, I actually look back on my life and I say, you know what, I didn't really do anything today. And that makes me feel a little bit down, especially with myself being a type A personality. My link to feeling good about myself is often through my achievements and what I've done and what I've produced. And so without that, I can feel my own mood kind of going downwards. So you can try to scale it back. You can ask them and teach them about what are the ways that social media pulls you in. But probably it's better if you limit the amount of time that someone spends on their smartphone and have maybe not at the table or not after this certain period of time. And if you can wait until someone is, past the level of 16, 17, till they use a lot of social media, or maybe they just use email, then there's much less of a chance that they're going to become addicted to social media afterwards. Similar in that way to smoking. Someone does not smoke by the age of 18. It is exceptionally rare that they will ever begin to smoke at all.
So they're now popping up in a lot of places. I think there's one really close to where we are now, are these rehab places for kids for gaming addiction and also for smartphone addiction, social media addiction. How do you know when someone needs that kind of intervention?
Well, what you want to do is you want to do the test of, can you not use it for a day and what happens to you? And you can see online, there's all kinds of videos of people having fits because they can't play a video game or use it. Like if your child is already at the stage where they will have a complete meltdown and throw things or, hurl insults at you, this is the time is now. So they're already dealing with that. But if not, you can just ask them and see. See if you limit it, if they cause a problem to them, if they don't mind, and you can actually do that and they only use it for, 2 hours a day and that's fine to that, then you don't really have a problem going through. And certain personality types are more linked to being addicted by social media. Or there are some people that have more of a biology that links them to addiction versus others. And so that also is part. So if in your family history, there's a lot of addiction in that, even if it's an alcohol addiction, they could be more linked to then being addicted to social media. So part of it is biology. Part of it is culture. Part of it is the upbringing. You have to kind of test it out. See if it is. For my kids, they earn points by being polite and also by doing homework and completing homework that I want them to do. And then they can earn time playing video games or VR, whichever way they want to do that. And that's nice because one is they feel proud and good about when they're on, and two, that it limits the amount of time that they're using it. So there's many different ways that you can do that, but you need to test it out. And a lot of parents feel that, well, my child is going to be angry or upset at me. Yes, but that's why you're a parent, is that, you're there to, raise them. You're not there to be their friend. So that does not hold much water. That's your job, is to sometimes make them upset.
Yeah, that's part of the deal, unfortunately. It's never fun.
Yeah.
But
Never fun.
Well, thank you so much for your expertise on that. It is such a challenge, and I know you're going to be writing a piece on this, so I will let everyone know when that's going to come out, or you can follow Georgia on Twitter. She'll probably tweet it out there. But yeah, and also you have the anxiety videos. I think anxiety is definitely part of this. So I know you don't have anything directed specifically at kids, but I know this is not just a problem with kids. And I think it is easier for adults to look at it. I mean, our brains are hopefully fully developed. They're not in that stage where we're just constantly, the more things we tell children are dangerous for them, the more appealing they seem to children, I think.
Yeah. And this is not that it's exactly dangerous itself. It's that it's within quantity of you're dealing with. And a lot of people with social anxiety, the fear of judgment of others, spend time on social media because they don't have to worry about that face-to-face rejection, which makes it much easier. So also it can end up being a crutch that will never have you go out because this is almost good enough.
Mm-hmm. We have some feedback. Jason from Australia writes, I would be interested to hear your thoughts on using an Amazon Echo in a country like Australia, where benefits such as online ordering from Amazon would be problematic. So I know you don't have an Echo in Canada, right?
No, we don't.
So why is it the Amazon is do you but you order from Amazon regularly, or is that problematic as well?
I do, yeah. No, I can order from Amazon, but we don't have the Echo here. And again, for me, it would be privacy issues that I'm not sure that I would feel comfortable mm-hmm. with the Echo.
Yeah. I mean, I think that, I don't know how it would be useful. I mean, I use it for a lot of things. So you're saying then in Canada, you can't buy it, or it's just, you wouldn't be able to connect to all of the,
there's
Alexa
no
features.
Service to that yet. Yeah. So,
yeah.
So. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. So yeah, just answer your own questions in Australia, right?
Yeah.
I realize that, I mean, as we're talking about addiction, like perhaps that the Amazon Echo is my addiction. They're all spread all over my house. And I just got another one because it was only $25 on Prime Day. So not a good one to ask.
And you got more of them. But there might not be an addiction. It may be just that, you know, you don't want to have to get up to be able to speak with your Echo.
Mm-hmm.
So you want it to be able to, you know, have a full house scale.
Mm-hmm.
Well, which is, that seems like a fine reason.
Yeah. Also, like,
or it was cheap. I don't know.
It was, well, yeah. I mean, it was $35 plus you got a $10 discount. I think that it still makes, you know, it doesn't, I don't feel guilt or shame over having it. I think it's funny and I will put it to good use. So I think then that passes the addiction test, or else maybe I just need to admit. I don't know. You can now start your Chevy with your Apple Watch. GM Authority says the My Chevrolet app, which allows for remote start and stop, horn honking, and door locking and unlocking and other features, is available on your wrist. My Cadillac is already available on the Apple Watch, and my Buick is coming. This all sounds very convenient, except I am wondering why you'd need to remotely stop your car with your Apple Watch. That seems like you should be in the car if it's going, but I don't, someone might need to help me out with that. Do you have a,
you might have a teen maybe that's using your car.
Oh, and you just want to stop that?
I don't know. It seems dangerous as well. I'm not really sure about that.
Every time that Leo honks his horn from his phone on his Tesla when it's out in the parking lot, I find that to be one of the amazing things about technology, which is crazy because there's a lot of amazing things about technology besides being able to honk your horn from the inside. But yeah, now you can get this app. And do you not? You don't have a remote start or stop app for your cars?
I don't, but I would completely love that. So I'm all on board. It's really cold here. To be able to start your car from inside where it's warm is lovely. So everyone that lives in a cold area, remote starters are great. And I actually don't have a remote starter on my car. It would be one of my wish lists of things to do. To be able to do it from my watch, I would love that. I would completely also honk my horn every now and then just to startle people for giggles.
I would absolutely do that. I get the remote start. Like, I totally get that. I've lived in cold climates before where it's, you know, nice to start your car without going outside. But the remote stop, I think I'll probably get like a bunch. Email me at megan@twit.tv for all the use cases for remotely stopping a car besides being a hacker. I'm sure there's just something I'm missing. Brian, remote stop? Do you know why you do this?
Nope.
Burke? Okay. All right. Well, someone out there.
No one in the chat room knows either. I don't have any reasons for why you could. Really, it's only if, like, you know, I guess if you see someone trying to steal your car.
Right.
You could stop it.
Yes.
But if someone I don't know.
My only guess is that, say you accidentally remote start your car and you don't want to have to go and actually physically stop it. You can do it from the app.
Okay.
That is a great. So it's not actually stopping the car from moving. It's turning the engine off.
Yes, that makes more sense.
Oh, okay. I thought it was being much more literal.
Me
to
too.
That. I thought it was stopping the car from moving. Like, now,
no, come back here, car.
That seems, now I feel a little bit ridiculous for, yeah, no, that's exactly what I thought. I thought it was from moving because, you know, mm-hmm. you couldn't reach the pedal. Your feet were doing, you had the itch under your foot. And so you didn't have to like take your foot and put it down because you're trying to itch. I don't know.
Right.
So no, turning off the engine makes sense because sometimes you turn on the engine and then you decide, you know what, I'm not going to go to the store to get whatever I wanted. And then you can just turn it off and not have to go outside. That makes sense.
Like you remote start it because it's snowing outside and then all of a sudden you get the word that it's a snow day. And so you stop it.
Right.
That happens all the time,
That's
right?
much better than...
Okay, yes. And you can also, this app also will help you find your car in the parking lot, which is super helpful.
Love that. I love that. Mm-hmm. I think everything should have that. I want to find everything. That is the way that I use my Apple Watch the most, is to try to find my phone, which always makes my husband laugh because often it's in my pocket or right next to me, but I've sat on it and lost it somewhere, so... I'm constantly having it beep to me. So to be able to find my car in a parking lot because I get lost in a circle, a good thing.
Yeah. Yeah. No, that is probably the most often used tool on my Apple Watch too, finding my phone, having it beep. And yeah. And I've gotten so used to it that, yeah, I no longer even look. Well, Georgia, what else are you up to? I know you do several podcasts in addition to your anxiety videos at anxiety-video that are fantastic, and you are on iMore. What else have you been up to that we need to know about?
That's mostly it. I have lived a pretty simple life, moving and getting everything together. So yeah, some podcasts. iMore will be doing some more videos after the summertime, and hopefully I'll be in a new place. It will not be the next time you see me will not be in the dungeon. I can't promise that though.
And then you'll probably have all kinds of smart home gadgets in your new place too.
Oh yes. That's the thing that's the hardest to give up for the home, is that we left the Ring and the Schlage locks and everything else that's there. So we will be, getting everything new.
Echobee?
Yes. Yes, Echobee? Definitely. I love my Echobee. It's great. So yeah, the people that get the house have that too.
Lucky for them.
Sad. Well, the worst part is they may not appreciate it. So
yeah,
it makes it even worse. I'm like, if you don't really like it, we'll switch it back. And
well, yeah, just tell them to read some of the articles on iMore about how great they are.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Well, thank you so much, Georgia. If you want more Georgia, you can also watch her on Twit over the weekend. And then there's the Disruption podcast and the iMore podcast. And hopefully we will have you back soon. Thanks so much for coming on, Georgia.
Thanks so much, Megan.
TNT records live every Monday through Friday at 4 p.m. Pacific, 7 p.m. Eastern. That's 2300 UTC at twit.tv/live. And you can be part of the show by emailing us at tnt@twit.tv. Or you can leave us a short voicemail at 260-TNT-SHOW. You can also find us on Twitter at TechNewsToday.tv. And you can subscribe to the show. Go to twit.tv/TNT. And if you want to tweet at me about why you'd want to remotely stop your car, please. I'm at Megan Maroney. And thanks to our technical director, Brian. Thank you to Burke for helping out in the studio. And thanks to Brian for editing the show. Yes, thank you, Brian, doing double duty today. And thanks to you for talking tech with us. We'll see you tomorrow.